Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matthew Miller, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Susan Weingarten about her new book, Haroset, A Taste of Jewish History, published by Toby Press in 2019. While every culture's cuisine tells a story, there are few foods that carry as much history and meaning as do those on the Passover Seder plate. Haroset, A Taste of Jewish History is the first book ever written about this traditional Passover Seder food. In a captivating historical journey, food historian Dr. Susan Weingarten traces the development of this ancient dish through a tapestry of social, religious, and cultural contexts. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Matthew.
I wonder if you can begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I was born in England, and I was actually in England during the Six-Day War. And when I heard that Jerusalem is in our hands on the radio, I thought, well, it's ridiculous to be in England. And it took a few years, and we came to Israel about 50 years ago now. This year it'll be 50 years. I at present live in Jerusalem. I lived in Tzfat for a bit. I've got 5 children and I think 16 grandchildren. And I'm a food historian. I originally wrote my doctorate on Saint Jerome, about what he could tell us about the Holy Land in the 4th century. But I got a bit tired of ascetic Christianity, so I moved on to Jewish food. And since then, I've been working on food, mostly in Talmudic sources. But when it came to Haroset, I wrote a paper about it for a conference, and then I wrote another paper. And when I came to writing a third paper, my husband said to me, well, it's about time you wrote a book. So it turned into a book.
And here we are at the book. What were the things that you had in the paper, and then what were the different things that you needed to add and think about as you came to turn a paper into a book?
Well, the papers... The first paper was about Haroset and authenticity. What's authentic and what isn't authentic? And it was at this point that I saw the great changes that have occurred in Haroset over the ages and how, yes, different sorts of Haroset are all authentic. And then I wrote another paper on the connection between Haroset and the blood libels. Normally, we associate blood libels with the dreadful accusations against Jews in the Middle Ages in Europe that they baked their matzah with Christian blood. Matzah doesn't look like something that's been baked with blood, but haroset, when it's made with red wine, could be. And there were, in fact, dreadful accusations of blood libels. And actually, the ones that concerned Haroset turned out okay because the French king in question was very fair. And at the trial, he agreed that the Jewish evidence held water and he didn't kill the Jews. I think that, unfortunately, the person that was accused at the time died of the torture, but the whole community wasn't decimated. And turning from this very fraught and difficult subject, finally, I actually managed to discover what the Greeks called charoset, what the Greek name for charoset was, and therefore when charoset might have begun and what its origins were. If it's got a Greek name, you know, its origins are likely to be in Greco-Roman Palestine, in other words, around the time of the Second Temple. And so it was these three papers from different aspects of charoset that meant that I decided to take everything right from what I saw as the beginning and work all the way through history, because it's a relatively restricted subject. It's not something absolutely huge, and therefore you can go through the whole of history, everything that ever was written, or everything that I could find that was ever written. I'm still finding things that aren't in the book, right? And sit there in a file on my computer called Second Edition. That's basically the way it was.
And so I think before we continue the interview and discuss different chapters, more of the history, maybe we'll start from the beginning and you can give us a definition. What exactly is charoset? What does the term mean?
That's a very good question, because it's not 100% clear at all. Probably, I think, the word charoset is related to the word for a piece of pottery, cheres. And charoset, and there are people that do say this, but not everybody agrees with them. Charoset is something that was there to represent the clay that the Jews made the bricks for in Egypt when Pharaoh was persecuting the Jews. One of the things he wanted them to do was to make bricks, and they worked very hard with the clay, and charoset is in memory of the clay. It has the memories of the Egyptian slavery, but also the memories of redemption. So it's a very nice ambivalent symbol. And when did it first appear on the Seder table? That's not clear. The first time we ever hear about charoset is in the Mishnah. And the Mishnah talks about the merchants in Jerusalem that used to tell people to get their spices for the charoset. And they talk about charoset as if it's something that everybody knows about. But of course, there's no explanation, certainly at that point. But the way I reconstruct it is this. Jews, we're told in Sefer Shemot, in the book of Exodus, that the Jews are supposed to, at the point of redemption, at the very point that they're being redeemed from Egypt, what does God tell them to do? God tells them to eat. And he tells them not only that they should eat, but what they should eat, and what they should eat it with, and how they should cook it. And he gives them a list of the foods that they're supposed to eat. They're supposed to eat the sacrificial paschal lamb, they're supposed to eat matzah, and they're supposed to eat bitter herbs. But no mention of charoset. So charoset must have appeared on the table sometime between the Exodus from Egypt and the Mishnah, which is a very long time span. The way I look at it is this. The bitter herbs were regarded by Greek and Roman doctors as something that was not good to eat, something that was bad for you. And they saw their Jewish neighbors sitting and at this most important meal, eating these bitter herbs. And they said, listen, this is not good for you. And the Jews said, really? And they said, yes, it's something that's really bad for the body, but you can make it okay if you dip it in the right sort of stuff. So they said, why don't you dip it in this thing called embama? Now, how do we know that embama is charoset? Well, in the Cairo Geniza, you know, the collection of documents and so on that they found in an old synagogue in Cairo, some of which date back to as early as the 10th century. In the Cairo Geniza, they found a little bit of a dictionary of the Mishnah, where they take difficult words in the Mishnah and translate them into Greek. They actually, it's all written in Hebrew letters, but the language that they use is Greek. So they have one entry which says, tribe embamo, and that's pound shafa charoset, the pounding charoset. And it's clear that the word that they're using for charoset is embama. Now, the Greek word embama means a dip, something that you dip things into. And there actually is a recipe for embama. And in the only Greco-Roman cookery book that survived, which in its present form dates to the 4th century, but actually has material going back to the 1st century. And it says that lettuce and endives, and they used bitter lettuce in those days. They didn't use horseradish. They use bitter lettuce and endives as their bitter herbs. And they say lettuce and endives can be corrected by dipping into this embama or oxyporium. And they give a recipe for embama or oxyporium. And it contains things like dates, which we do find in charoset, and it also contains some rather strange sort of spices, but some of them are found in different forms of charoset, and anyway, spices do change. So there's this dip that people used to use to make the lettuce and the endives not harmful. Now, in the Babylonian Talmud, they talk about using charoset to counteract the kappa of the bitter herbs. And it's a bit unclear what kappa means. It's got various possibilities. It could mean the bad juices in the bitter herbs. It could also mean a demon. Now, the Babylonian Talmud is full of demons. It's one of the things that they like talking about quite often, and they go off into a spell against demons and so on, but then they come back to the idea of the juices in the bitter herbs. So both your Greco-Roman recipe and the Babylonian Talmud both say that charoset is a good thing against the bitterness, really, of the bitter herbs. And I think that this is how it appeared. We know that after the temple was destroyed and the rabbis went to Yavne and decided how they're going to rebuild Judaism, one of the things they did was to move the celebration of Passover, Pesach, from Jerusalem into the home of every single Jew. And I think it must have been around that time that charoset, which was on the table already, was given an okay by the rabbis. And it's also the reason why the rabbis are not 100% certain exactly exactly how to classify it. The suggestion that I can't remember who it is who gives it says that when we make a bracha over the lulav and the etrog and the hadas and the aravot, we only make the bracha over the lulav, and the other things are included with it. So perhaps it's the same with charoset. We make the bracha over maror, and the charoset is included in it. And this, the Rambam also classifies it as what as a sort of second class mitzvah. It's a mitzvah that belongs to the sofrim, to the scribes. So, yeah, there's this whole thing about whether charoset is a mitzvah or not. I suspect that if it is a mitzvah, that this is one of the reasons why you very often nowadays find men making charoset. Although usually it's the woman who does all these things, but if it's a mitzvah, perhaps it's too important to leave to a mere woman, and therefore you get men making charoset. And I had a lot of people giving me wonderful descriptions of how their father-in-law found difficulty in peeling the apples, but he persisted because it was one of the things he had to do. Yeah.
Maybe we can back up a little bit. So we were speaking about the different sources that you're looking at for this particular research project. And you mentioned in general, one of the main resources that you're looking at is the Talmud. And then, of course, following up with different commentaries, etc. But thinking about the Talmud itself, were there any methodological issues that you had when looking at it and when using it as a source? Because although, of course, it contains historical material, it's not first and foremost a history book as such. So how did you think about the Talmud as a source for your research?
Well, generally, when I look at the Talmudic sources as a source for my research, and I do a lot of research on food in the Talmud, I generally, yes, don't regard it as somebody who's writing something to be history. So you will get a lot of information about food in different sort of contexts. But here with charoset, what we are interested in is the halakha. And the Talmud is totally concerned with the halakha and gives us all sorts of rules and regulations for things. Of course, we've no idea how far people actually kept to these rules and regulations, but we don't know very often whether the Talmud's being prescriptive or descriptive. So one of the things that they are interested in is how charoset was made and what it was made of, but they're also interested in what it symbolized, which is not really halakha, but it's one of the things that the rabbis are particularly interested in. The reason that you need to make charoset, the Talmud tells us, the Talmudim tell us that charoset should be thick, but then some people disagree and say no, it should be soft or runny, and they try. It's clear that there's a disagreement here, and that different people take the different suggestions. There's also a suggestion that it should be sour. Now, charoset nowadays is almost never sour. I don't know that I actually met anybody that has charoset that's totally sour, although I met somebody who said that in his childhood they used to make it sour. They used to use vinegar. Somebody from Gibraltar, and he said it was dreadful and really awful, and this was his father's minhag to put vinegar in the charoset. And luckily his mother's family had a different minhag, and they went over to his mother's custom rather than his. In fact, the vinegar in the charoset and the apples, which were sour apples originally and not sweet apples like we have them today, you get in the Jerusalem Talmud a discussion of whether it should be thick or like clay or runny like blood. And the Tosfot eventually come to the idea that you can do both, that you can make it thick at first, and then you can add wine at the table so that it's runny. And you do actually find pictures in the Middle Ages from Spain of charoset in the form of little balls. And clearly you can't dip into a little ball. You have to add wine. But there was a problem with the idea of the blood. And you get the Taz, the Torei Zahav, in the 17th century saying you shouldn't use red wine because it looks like blood. He'd lived through the Chelmniki massacres and he realized that it was a dangerous thing. And today there are quite a lot of families who still have their thick charoset and then add wine at the table, but they're all Sfaradim. And it's the Sfaradim were not the subjects of the blood libels usually. And of course, everybody's gone back now to using red wine, presumably because the memory of the blood and the memory of the blood libels has been lost.
One of the things that I think about when I look at the book, and I think about the book, is the description on the top. It says, an intriguing exploration of one of the most mysterious symbolic Passover foods. We've touched on certain aspects of this, the food part, the symbolic part to some degree. One of the things I want to pick up a little bit more on, which we've addressed a little bit, is the mysterious aspect. So we've said that, is it a mitzvah? Is it not a mitzvah? Is there a blessing on it? Is there not a blessing? I think we've covered also some other aspects. But from your perspective, what are some of these other mysterious aspects of the charoset that makes it a little bit difficult to understand?
That wasn't one of my one of the things that I would have written about it. I don't know that it's particularly mysterious. I think that that there are a lot of questions, but as far as I could see, they could usually be answered. I think that this is a bit of the blurb of the publisher that thought that people might be more excited if they read that it was mysterious. I don't know that I would say mysterious. I would say interesting and with a lot of questions around it, but an awful lot of those questions can be answered. True, the name of charoset is still not totally clear to us, but I wouldn't call it exactly mysterious. Perhaps unclear is a better word. And there are a lot of things that you can clarify. There are all sorts of strange customs, strange minhagim that turn up over the centuries. There's the one that I think the very first the first time that it's mentioned is by the Shibboleth HaLeket in Italy, where they actually add a bit of a little bit of grit to the charoset. Charoset's in the memory of clay, so you add a bit of pounded clay to your charoset. And you get the most wonderful reactions to this. I actually photographed, and there's a photograph in the book of somebody who takes a hammer and takes a bit of pottery and bashes it up. He's always tells me he always boils the piece of pottery first to make sure it's clean, and then he takes a hammer and bashes it and pours the bits of grit into his harosid, not very much, so that you're most unlikely to get a bit between your teeth, but it's there, and it's there because of what appears to have been a misprint that you had in your manuscript or your book or whatever, that you must pound the haroset. Now, if you leave the last letter off haroset, it says you must pound the cheres, and cheres is the potsherd. So, in other words, people went round pounding their potsherds because of a misprint. And there's actually one rabbi who says this and says that it's a misprint, and he says it's the most ridiculous idea that people won't give up this custom. He says it's absolutely crazy, this custom, and any minute they'll be doing even crazier things like bloodletting on Purim or something. He says it's meant to be a memory of the clay, but not the clay itself. But people, it didn't help. It's the Chida, Rabbi Chaim David Azulai, who says this and who is violently against the minhag, but it didn't help because there are still people that do it to today, and you still find it written in mostly some of the older Haggadot. But I found a Haggadah from, I think, maybe the 19th century where it was still written. So, yes, there are, but you can explain the whole of that strange happening. Whether that's mysterious and I've solved the mystery, I don't know. But there are all sorts of little quirks that you come across on the way for this. The non-religious kibbutzim simply got rid of haroset, and I went into this. I sat for a long time in the kibbutz. The kibbutzim have a historical archive with the haggadot from every kibbutz, and kibbutzim used to write a different haggadah for each kibbutz. Had their own haggadah, and they would simply cut out haroset. And I think this was because the kibbutzim at the very beginning were very antagonistic to the idea of the Jew that came from the shtetl in Eastern Europe, and they wanted to produce a new type of Jew, and they weren't going to have things that they couldn't really explain. They kept the matzah and they kept the wine, and that was about it. The only mention of haroset that I found in the archive, and I didn't go over all of it, but I went over quite a lot of the Haggadah, apart from the religious kibbutzim, where obviously haroset was just ordinary. The only place where I found a mention of it was somewhere where they were historicizing it. This is part of history. Once upon a time, people used haroset. I think also because it was made of expensive spices, it was a luxury. And kibbutzim were against luxury. They were very ascetic at the very beginning. And so, yeah, you can find the sources of an awful lot of the strange customs if you look hard enough, I think.
Thank you for that. That was a great tour of some of the peculiarities and, as I said, difficult to understand aspects of the haroset, but those which can be explained if one understands the history. I wanted to unpack two other quirks that we had either touched on or had not yet touched on. One of them is the apple. So you mentioned tapuach is one of these items, a sour apple, which had been used, is also currently used in many recipes. I wanted to unpack that and discuss whether or not tapuach is in fact apple, or as you discuss in the book, could it in fact be a citron, or is that not a good reading of historical sources? And then the other question I wanted to know about is the other thing that you talk about is haroset as a food item we've been talking about, but we haven't really said whether or not it's actually eaten. So those two things are quirks, which I think could be helpful to unpack.
Right. So if I may, I'll start with the, is haroset eaten? So I mentioned already the fact that in the Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud that we usually use, the Bavli, they talk about the fact that you shouldn't leave the bitter herbs for too long in the haroset because they might lose some of their bitterness. And therefore, there are some Jews, especially German Jews, the Yekin, are so afraid that that there might be too long a contact between the bitter herbs and the haroset, and the bitter herbs might lose their bitterness, that they simply dip the herbs into the haroset and then shake the haroset off and don't eat it at all. So that, yes, is definitely one of the stranger minhagim that I found. I discovered it when I went to a family to talk to them about their haroset, and I asked the father what he put in his haroset, and he said, "I don't know, ask my wife." And she said, "Oh," she said, "he always just dips the bitter herbs in and then shakes it off, so I never waste my time making it. I just buy it." So that's the not using the haroset, whereas other families say, "I have to make an enormous quantity because the children want to eat it for the whole week, and that's what they spread on their matzah." Now, the apple is very interesting. Nowadays, haroset has a geographical spread. The Sephardi Jews base their haroset on dates, and that goes all the way back to Sadia Gaon and to the idea that haroset has to be thick. Ashkenazi Jews base their haroset on apples, because in the Babylonian Talmud, and Ashkenazim go for the Babylonian Talmud, it talks about the haroset is in memory of the apple. Doesn't actually say the apple should be in haroset, but it says it's in memory of the apple because apples are sour. In ancient times, apples were sour, much more sour than they are now. We've bred them to get sweeter and sweeter and sweeter over the years, and nowadays it's almost impossible to find a sour apple. When I was a child in England, there were what were called cooking apples that were really sour, but nowadays we only have sweet and sour apples. And in the middle of this geographical spread of the Ashkenazi apples and the Sephardi dates, you have the haroset in the Balkans, in Greece and in Turkey, which is based on raisins. But you're interested in the apples, and the apples are very interesting. As I say, they were originally there to add sourness, but then they got into the haroset themselves, because if they're there to add sourness, then they become an essential ingredient. And they're there because of a very beautiful midrash, which I call the haroset midrash, whereby when Pharaoh in Egypt, according to the text in Exodus, said that all Jewish boy babies should be killed, but the girls can be left alive. The Jewish couples in Egypt, according to the Midrash, separated from each other so that the women wouldn't get pregnant and so that they wouldn't have children who would be killed. Until, and the Midrash says it was Miriam, Moses' sister, said to her parents, "Listen, you're worse than Pharaoh. Pharaoh's only killing the boy babies, but you're making sure there'll be no girl babies either." So her parents went back together, and the other Jewish women seduced their own husbands under the apple tree, according to the Midrash. And the women brought their husbands under the apple tree, brought them jugs of water, and God made a miracle whereby little fishes appeared in these jugs, and they heated them up, and they ate fish as well under the apple tree. And then later, having got pregnant, they gave birth under the apple tree. And the Midrash is beautiful. The Midrash said God sent an angel to them to be their midwife and to look after the women after they'd given birth, so that Pharaoh wouldn't know that the babies had been born, and that would perhaps save the boy babies. So this is seen as a Midrash of redemption and the continuity of the Jewish people, right? Also a Midrash, I think, of married love as well. The women seduced their own husbands. And it's a very beautiful Midrash. And from this, the Tosfot said that this allegorization of the apple comes from the Midrash on the Song of Songs. And you should put in your haroset the fruits that appear in Midrashim on the Song of Songs, the fruits that the people of Israel are compared to in the Song of Songs. So you get apples, you get nuts, you get dates, you get figs, you get pomegranates. Now, obviously, it was difficult over the ages to get all these ingredients. They weren't always available everywhere. When one of the Tosfists in London, before the expulsion of the Jews from England in the 13th century, says you should put pomegranates in your haroset, I think he's probably talking about a textual tradition rather than a food tradition. I think it's most unlikely that they managed to get hold of pomegranates in London in the 13th century. In fact, there's a document which said that they went to buy 18 oranges and 200 pomegranates for the Queen of England at the time. And if it was something special, very, very special for the Queen, I think ordinary Jews are most unlikely to have been able to get hold of it. But it's there in the Tosfot. But later on, it drops out. And Ashkenazi haroset today is almost exactly the same wherever you find Ashkenazi Jews. It doesn't matter where they come from. They're little changes, but I learned a little rhyme when I was a child. Apples, raisins, chopped up fine, cinnamon, nuts, and sweet red wine. And that is the Ashkenazi haroset. Sephardi haroset is completely different, and different communities have different minhagim, have all sorts of different things. They do tend to be based on dates, but they put all sorts of other marvelous things in, the ginger, sesame seed, which for Ashkenazim are sometimes considered to be kitniot and not allowed on Pesach. The Persian Jews do use pomegranates. And to my mind, I mean, my grandparents came from Lithuania, and I have standard Ashkenazi haroset at home as my tradition. But I do think the Persian haroset's better. I think it's the best of all of them. And they told me a wonderful story, some of the Jews from... I can't remember. I think maybe Kurdish Jews, that on Simchat Torah, you know that the Sfaradim have their Sefer Torah in a wooden box that's like a sort of tube, but it's got a flat top. unlike the Ashkenazi Sifrei Torah, which have handles at the top and they do have rimonim, pomegranates, but the Sfaradim put the most beautiful apples and pomegranates on top of the Sefer Torah on Simchat Torah, and then they take them and put them in cold storage and keep them to till Pesach, the ones that have been on the Sefer Torah, and then those are the fruit that they use to make their charoset with, which is I think really lovely custom.
I was also wondering about the whole tapuach as citron and
how that's as citron. I think this is pilpul. I think this is rabbis who are enjoying playing with things and not thinking about tradition so much, but enjoying playing with the meanings of words. And if in one place it says that this wasn't really an apple, it was an etrog, it was a citron, so in another place you can suggest it. And then there's this absolutely wonderful comment, which I think it was a Satmara Rav who made it, and he said, well, he said, if you have a real apple tree, as opposed to an etrog tree, there'd be more room for the women for the women to give birth under a real apple tree than under an etrog tree, because that comes very low to the ground and has lots of prickles on it. I think that's absolutely lovely, and I really liked that, and it wasn't strictly relevant, so I put it in a footnote. I don't think anybody thought of etrogim in the Middle Ages when they were talking about apples. I think they were really thinking about actual apples. An etrog was something very, very hard to get hold of. I suppose you could have kept it from Sukkot till Pesach, it wouldn't be very edible. So it seems to be most unlikely. I have looked into etrogim actually and the trade in them and how difficult it was. Sometimes communities had one etrog for the whole community and they had to, you know, give it to each person and as a present so that it would be his, so that he could use it for the mitzvah. I think certainly over the ages that they couldn't possibly have used etrogim. And this is just one of the games with words. Pesach is the Haggadah, the whole idea is full of these games with words. There are games with words over Haroset as well. The Ari talks about Haroset Even and Haroset Etz. An Even, a stone, it doesn't mean a stone, it's a joke. It's the initial letters of Apfel, Biren, Nusser, apples, pears, and nuts in German. And Etz is Ingbar and Zimmerind, ginger and cinnamon, because those were the ingredients of particularly German Haroset. You actually got pictures in Haggadot where they show them peeling the pears and the apples, and they have little rhymes saying that they're preparing their haroset from apples, pears, and nuts. Yeah.
You mentioned previously that since the time this book was written in 2019 or published in 2019, that you've got a file for the second edition. Are there any things you've discovered, any ideas you've come across that have made you fully rethink what you've written, or overall they're just additions to what you've already written?
Most of them are just additions, but I have rethought some of the stuff I wrote about the Ari. I've discovered new material that I wasn't aware of, and I'm afraid I'm not very I'm a mitnag from a mitnagid family, right? Not from a Hasidic family, and I didn't really do good enough research on Hasidut, and there are actually some very interesting things there that came up, that somebody was kind enough to write to me and send me a whole lot of sources. It was really wonderful that people actually bother to do things like that. I was just delighted.
And we can learn about that. We'll do a second interview for the second edition.
Right, okay.
So Susan, I've taken up a lot of your time. I want to make sure that we can close off in a good way. What are you working on next?
I'm working on a book on Talmudic food. Food generally in the Talmudic literature, which is both Mishnah, Tosefta, Midrashim, and both the Talmudim, and setting the food in Eretz Yisrael in its Greco-Roman setting, and the food of the Babylonian Talmud, I compare to, there's cookery books of the caliphs of Baghdad, which are a little, but at the same time as the Gaonim, and explain quite a lot of the food in the Babylonian Talmud that we, you know, people haven't worked out what they are. And it's great. I'm really enjoying it.
I look forward to reading that. And I'm getting hungry just thinking about it. So
I have to finish writing it first.
All right. So when you finish writing it, I'd love to read it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. This has been great.
Thank you, Matthew. It's about time I started thinking about Haroset. It's nearly Pesach anyway.
Exactly.
Okay. Be well.
We have been talking to Susan Weingarten, author of Haroset, A Taste of Jewish History, published by Toby Press in 2019. Happy reading, my friends.